Hey, welcome in the garage, Big Jim's Garage. I'm Big Jim O'Brien, your host here, and let's grab our guest here right now. Tim Sendrick, president of Penske Performance. Tim, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
How's Indy? Detroit is beautiful right now. We're talking about the Detroit Grand Prix here, but I'm watching the testing yesterday in Indy. It was a good day for Penske.
Yeah, for sure. To get out there the first day with new aero kits and that type of thing, and be quick out of the box, it's a good sign for things to come, I hope.
Do you as you guys, is this something, because there's such a long build up to Indy, is it almost like you don't want to tip your hand a little bit too soon?
You know, it's more about really what you're trying to focus on, and I don't think everybody gets too serious about qualifying until Friday afternoon. You're just so focused on the race setups, because at the end of the day, you can really win this race from anywhere.
Is that kind of, Tim, one of the things that I've noticed? Are we just noticing this more, that we see more fuel mileage races? Or is that this seems like in a lot of the series now, I've noticed that the fuel mileage is playing more of a game, or we're just more aware of it?
I think we're probably more aware of it, because fuel mileage is always important. It always has been. Whether or not you need it to get to the end of the race, or simply, wanting to put less fuel in than your competitor, because it's so competitive now that any time you can save on pit road really matters. So I think sometimes people get confused with fuel mileage races are the ones that really come down to, can you make it to the end, versus trying to make good fuel mileage to lose less time in the pits and gain track position, throughout the day. So it's important no matter what.
So where do you find the balance then? I know with Chevrolet last year, there was a lot of talk that maybe Honda's had a little more giddy up last year, but it seems like you guys have come with a strong engine package. Where do you find that balance between performance and mileage?
Well, I think you strive to have both. It's kind of cliche as that sounds. Or cliche. it's really a matter of trying to, because we have 8 different fuel positions or power positions on the steering wheel, and that's, per the regulations, that you try and have the best of both. You try and have a position in which you can go, full blast when really your fuel isn't a concern anymore, or you're trying to get distance behind you, or from a fuel mileage perspective, you're trying to go as lean as you possibly can to get to the end of the race. And then there's one where we call kind of best lean power. And a lot of it has to do with the track configurations, because some configurations only have certain passing zones. And in the areas that aren't passing zones, you want to save more fuel in those spots, because typically guys can't get around you.
So when you're talking about, like here, obviously in Detroit, DetroitGP.com for the Detroit Grand Prix on Belle Isle. So some of the, like just what you said, Tim, based on the passing zones that you have on Belle Isle, maybe there's not as many fuel settings on the car?
Well, you would have the same number of settings.
Okay.
But
that you're actively using, I guess.
The areas in which you would save fuel. So on the straightaways and that type of thing, honestly, some drivers will switch the knob throughout the lap because you'll be running really lean in the twisty sections, and then you'll want all the fuel you can in the straight sections in the passing zones. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. No, Simon was saying that he thought you may get up to 200 miles an hour this year at Belle Isle.
I could do. It just depends really on what the tires are. We don't really know what the tires are until we arrive. So, the tires obviously are the biggest influence on the car aside from the engine. So, how the tires react and what the difference is between the reds and the blacks, and obviously the weather. So, I think 200 might be a stretch, but I think it'll be somewhere near there.
Was one of the things that we're talking with Tim Sendrick, president of Penske Performance. One of the things, Tim, I'm always interested in is group dynamics. Because when I watch the Penske drivers as a whole, and I was thinking about this year, one of the most interesting case studies I've ever seen isn't Penske, but what's going on with Red Bull and F1. To have two drivers, one of them is in the last year of his deal, one young driver who is very aggressive. I'm doing the PC, the air quotes right now. And how they're dealing with it. But you've got so many young drivers being like Joseph and now Ryan Blaney and stuff as you go across the board. Team dynamics in Penske just seem to work. And I don't know how you guys do it sometime with so many drivers.
I think a lot of it, honestly, is who you choose or who's and what criteria you utilize to choose your drivers is a big part of it. There's a lot of talented drivers out there, and a lot of them wonder why they don't get opportunities. And, you know, in our organization, we certainly stress the team atmosphere. And, you know, here it's an open book. Formula One, in particular, your biggest threat and your biggest enemy in some ways is your teammate.
Right.
And that mentality doesn't typically bode a very good atmosphere. So, you know, from our standpoint, I think Juan Montoya is probably the best example of somebody you could talk to explain the team dynamics and the differences. It's a really interesting conversation with Juan because he's been obviously in different teams, whether it's NASCAR, IndyCar, and Formula One, and now our sports car program with Acura. And, you know, his take on it is so unique, and it's actually pretty refreshing for us to kind of check the box to say that it's the right way, and it's a way that not only, you know, the people around you, but the people that work with the drivers, you know, that they feel a part of it. So it's, you know, it's a testament to really what Roger's created and what he's demanded from the beginning.
Well, to your point, talking about how you're not competing amongst yourselves, you know, you still want to win. Obviously, that's the point of the sport. But when Ryan Blaney had the incident with Larson last week, and I saw that interview with Jamie afterwards, I went on social media immediately and said, he's become my new favorite driver just based on that. He didn't try to blame the team or the tires or the aero or anything else. He owned it. So they were racing hard, and it happened. And he apologized to Kyle, you know, and just the way he talked, I'm like, there's a guy who's confident in his own skin and knows that his team's got his back. And so many times when I watch motorsports, I don't see that.
Yeah, no, you got it. You got it. It's refreshing. And I was proud of the way he handled it. And certainly, you know, he's really the first one that we've been able to bring up from really right out of high school, you know, into a successful winning cup driver. And, you know, we've taken a couple shots at it with a couple different drivers, and, you know, we felt as though we failed in a few instances. And, you know, with Ryan, you know, we take a lot of pride in the fact that he grew up in our organization, really from the beginning.
Are you concerned, going back to Indy, we're talking with Tim Sendrick here, are you concerned about maybe IndyCar trying to keep it too common car with the body design, not letting you guys modify these vehicles?
Yeah, it's been the mentality for quite a while within IndyCar. And it's, you know, I think cost containment is very important, don't get me wrong, but there's certain ways in which, you know, teams need to be able to, I say that to have racing that's interesting, it needs to be unpredictable, and you need to be able to make bad decisions. If there's really no decisions to be made, in other words, everybody runs all the same stuff and the settings are pretty simple, it's hard to differentiate yourself, therefore it's hard to pass. So, yeah, you want to be able to be sure that you have an environment in which your people can think for themselves and collectively make good decisions or bad decisions. And that typically makes it more interesting for the fans.
Well, it doesn't matter how much you try to control cost or anything. Last time I checked, somebody's going to be in first, somebody's going to be in last. I mean, that's just the way it is. Not every team is going to be successful. It just, you cannot try to force a sport or a series to be like that. It never works.
No, and you know, I think back to my childhood and all the way through all the different sports. And the years in which there was parity, I don't remember too much, honestly.
It's true. Nobody wants to see a 9-7 team in the Super Bowl. Nobody does.
No, and you know, when you think back to it and you think about what everybody talks about, it's the years and the eras and the times in which you feel like you were noticing something special, you were witnessing excellence. And I think excellence is what should be rewarded. And, you know, this mentality of having it equal opportunity for everyone, really at the end of the day, there's people involved and the people make the difference. So, you know, no matter how much, you know, the cars are regulated or how open they are, the people and the drivers in particular are going to be the ones that make the difference. And, you know, no one has ever won a race by themselves, you know, as far as an automobile race.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's still a team sport, and that's what, you know, makes it interesting and makes it unique in some ways, is there's equipment involved, i.e. a car.
Maybe Junior Johnson, when he was smoking a cigarette, running the pit crew and the crew chief at the same time.
Yeah, maybe. But, maybe. He wasn't there by himself.
That's true.
Tim
Sindrick, it is interesting, though, like you said, and I always go back to the COT. I mean, I get what NASCAR was trying to do back then, but it became IROC racing to me, and I didn't know who was who.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, there's a place for an IROC type event, but, you know, the series and really you have to determine what is it that you're trying to attract and what is it are you trying to do. But at the same time, you can't, it also comes down to you want to have 33 cars. You have to have somebody to pass, as Roger says. So you have to be able to understand what your goals are as a team. And, you know, sometimes I remember growing up where it was some team's goal to run all 500 miles. It was other team's goals to make the race. Others wanted to finish on the lead lap, and then others expected to win. And there were different levels of achievement and different levels of expectations. And that's all changed a bit, and I understand why. But no, I do think that, back to your original question, that having areas in which you can differentiate yourself. I mean, we came to the IRL in 2001 when you had the CART IRL split.
Yeah.
And when we came back, there were actually, and that was supposed to be, you know, efficient racing. And the reason why a lot of the teams left CART was to go to a less expensive series. And there were more areas on that car that we could design or change than are on the existing car, which I find pretty ironic.
Really? Wow. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
So what do you think about, I've heard rumblings now, McLaren's interested in maybe coming into Indy next year, into IndyCar?
I read the same thing. Really, I don't speculate on too much of that stuff until it actually happens. But I think it's good that there's interest from an international organization like that to come back into the sport. You know, it bodes well for IndyCar.
Is it a compliment for you guys when people talk about Penske? I've heard people go, they're like the Yankees. You're like the Yankees of racing. I mean, you're so big and so well put together, the organization. Is that a compliment or a shot?
No, we take a lot of pride in that. And the fact that, you know, there's a legacy there. And obviously, the Yankees are really, you know, a name in which, you know, is very, very American, you know, to the rest of the world. And, you know, I think the Penske brand continues to build itself, you know, not only in this country, but worldwide. When you see us racing in Australia and the businesses we have there, and the businesses we have in Australia now, combined with what we have in Europe, it's really become a worldwide brand. And, you know, that's we all take a lot of pride in that, for sure.
Did you get over to Bathurst?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been there many times. I probably go to Australia 6 or 8 times a year. And, yeah, I've been to Bathurst probably 6 or 7 times now when you include the 12-hour race. My son raced in the 12-hour race twice now, so I went over for that, as well as the Bathurst 1000, probably 3 or 4 times now.
Is it as fun to be there as it is to watch on TV? That's one of the craziest races I've ever seen.
Oh, without a doubt, it's probably one of the most unique places in the world. I would put it in the top 5 motor races to ever attend. There's no place like it. I can't really describe to you what it's like in terms of the racetrack, but if you've been to Laguna Seca, if you've been to Elkhart Lake, if you combine those two tracks, raise the elevation about twice as high, have double the number of corkscrews, narrow the track by a third, and put cement walls all the way around it, you got a pretty good idea of what it's like. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, when you watch them coming down, it looks like a sharper descent than the corkscrew.
Well, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Before they put the chicane there, it was even more dangerous, I guess you would call it, but you know, to come down, you know, you're coming down there 180, 190 miles an hour, and you know, you're into a chicane and then a sharp left. It's quite the place. But the fact that there's so many blind corners, and you're basically racing up and down a city street that's on top of a mountain. It's everybody should do that trip that has the chance.
I still love, what was it? Was it Weber or Button that did the F1 lap on at Bathurst?
I think it was Button, if I remember correctly.
That's insane. Yeah, the Vodafone car. That's Looney Tunes. Man, there's so much. Tim, so what? So now you got Indy. You obviously got Indy. You got the shootout in Charlotte. What's your schedule like this week? Then are you going to stay at Indy? Or are you going to go to Charlotte? Come back? What? How does this work?
Yeah, I typically go anytime that the cars are on track in Indy. I'm in Indy.
So you're going to have
I go back and forth.
You're going to be there. How many hours? How many hours do you think you'll be at Indy this month?
I have no idea. No idea.
It's constant, isn't it? I mean, you get up and it's just, is it a 24-hour? I know the drivers talk about that. It's a 24-hour thing.
Yeah, mentally it is to a certain degree, but it's what you make it. You have to get away from it a little bit. The garage opens at 8 in the morning, closes at 9 at night on the practice days, and then it's more on the weekends. But, they're long days. You know, the crew guys are constantly, given different challenges, throughout the day. So it's a long month, but
and then you come home afterwards.
The biggest race in the world.
It is, and then you come home for the Detroit Grand Prix, man. I mean, it's like you don't really get to catch your breath, but we love this race here. It is just growing every single year when we're on Belle Isle.
Yeah, Belle Isle. It's amazing, really, what's been done with that facility and the island there and so forth. It's I had been to the race many years, on and off the island. And, I can't say enough about the job that, Bud Danker and all those guys have done with, taking Belle Isle to a whole nother level. So, hats off to all them. We look forward to it every year, even though it's the hardest stretch of the IndyCar season to go from Indianapolis. And now you include the Grand Prix here. So you run the Grand Prix, then you run the Indy 500, you do the double at Detroit, and then you go on to Texas the next week. So, without a doubt, that's the time in which you want the most success because you need that morale.
Wow. I envy you guys, man. And it's going to be fun. I'm going to Indy this year for the very first time, taking my 14-year-old son. We're going to go. We'll be in
that's
the short.
Awesome.
We're in the short shoot right out of turn one. We're looking forward to it. Tim, hey, last question. I'll leave you alone after this. I promise. If you could take the IndyCar series to one track overseas, where would it be?
One track overseas.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd have to give that a little bit of thought, honestly. I think that, there's a lot of places over there, and a lot of them I honestly haven't been to.
I keep thinking about Spa. I that's the one Joseph said he wants to go to Spa just once.
Yeah, I mean, that's top of mind for sure. Without a doubt, it would be one of the best ones. You think about Monaco, not for the race layout, but just for the history that's gone through there. And then, obviously to be able to run a place like Silverstone with all the history that's happened there, it'd be a hard choice, honestly, Jim.
Right. Yeah. And I just this week, actually, you mentioned Monaco. It was the anniversary of Senna's lap, the qualifying lap at Monaco.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, as an owner, do you watch that as much as like we do as geeky fans? I watch that and go, how did he do that in that car?
Yeah, I think all the those times, there's so many things you can look at, and things have changed so much in terms of just what's acceptable and, what's perceived as safe and what was dangerous at that point in time. You go back to the races in the 60s even, and, you just wonder what the mentality of those drivers were and how difficult that was to wake up race day, understanding the dangers in front of you for that particular day. Not that today it's dangerous now, but today relative to what it was back then, that was a different breed for sure.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think the one thing we can all agree upon is that Bobby Unser did not pass more cars than necessary against Mario Andretti.
Now he has the trophy.
My Unser bias coming out at the end of this interview. Tim Sindrick, president of Penske Performance. And I guarantee you that Roger Penske called you sometime at night for the job, right? Because he never sleeps. When did you get the job offer? What time of night?
Oh, it was about 10 o'clock.
There it is.
you got it.
Dude never sleeps. He never sleeps. He's amazing to me. He drove around.
He's on Roger time.
Oh, is that what you guys call it? Is Roger time?
Yeah. He's on his own time.
All right. Well, Tim, I know you're busy. Get to the track there. We will see you there for the Indy 500 here in Detroit, DetroitGP.com. This was a blast, man. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. I'm a huge fan of what you guys do across all the series and continue to expand the Penske Performance brand worldwide, man. Congratulations on everything.
Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate it, and enjoy being on the show.
Thanks, man.